Good to be here again. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about a paper that I put out a few weeks ago with Yingxuan Lin, who's a postdoc at Caltech. And the title looks very mathematical, but I think some of the aspect will hopefully be of interest to high energy people and condensed matter people. It's a project I really enjoy that combines various different techniques that I've been thinking about for a while. And so it will be mainly based on this paper, but I will also use some of the techniques that we have developed in these two other papers. So I personally like talk that having only one punchline, so I'm going to give up the punchline right now. The punchline is that we're very familiar in using global symmetry to constrain various quantum systems. But from the modern perspective, global symmetry should be naturally generalized to topological defects. So whenever you say global symmetry has some implication A, B, C, you should also ask the same question for topological defects. And that's basically the main point of the whole project. And hopefully I will make it clear what do I mean by this. And that will be the rest of the talk. So we should really think about global symmetry as a subset of what is known as the topological defects. And whatever you can say about global symmetry, you should be able to make an analogous statement for topological defects. So let me be more clear about what do I mean by that. So given a zero form, ordinary global symmetry, we know that there's an associated topological defect that's codimension one in space-time. So the word topological defect might sound a little bit fancy, but it's actually something we are very familiar with. For example, if you take the U1 continuous global symmetry, then we know Noether theorem tells us that there's a conserved local spin one operator whose integral over some codimension one surface in space-time give you the charge operator. And the charge operator here is what I meant by the topological defect. It's topological in the sense that if you deform the locus of the manifold a little bit, you won't change the answer as long as you don't pass any charge operator. And that follows from the current conservation equation in the case of a continuous global symmetry. It's codimension one, because for zero-form global symmetry, we have a spin one current, and more often than not, you take the current and you integrate it at a fixed time over the whole space. But in a Euclidean space-time setting, you can choose any codimension one manifold in your space-time and integrate your current. For continuous global symmetry, we are used to working with just the Noether current, and the charge operator will be a consequence of it. But for discrete global symmetry, you don't have the luxury of having a local conserved Noether current. And therefore, you skip this step and directly work with the charge operator, which should be a topological codimension one defect. So this is all very standard, known for maybe close to 100 years by now. But we can ask the following question. So far the arrow goes this direction. If we have a global symmetry, we know there has to be a codimensional topological defect that's implementing the symmetry operation on local operators. But is the reverse arrow true or not? Namely, is every codimensional topological defect in your quantum field theory associated with some global symmetry? And the answer is actually no. It's no in the sense that there are topological defect that's not associated with any global symmetry. And it's precisely in that sense that I mean topological defects are natural generalization of global symmetry. And whenever we make a statement about global symmetry, we should ask ourselves the same question for topological defects. And today's talk, or more specifically this paper, is to apply this philosophy in the particular case of monster CFD. But we'll get to that later. So far the discussion is very abstract, but now let me talk about an example that I think everyone should be more or less familiar with. So to talk about to introduce the topological defects that are not associated with any global symmetry, it's actually most natural to consider the following example. And it's most natural to talk about it in the context of bosonization and fermionization. There's one more thing I forgot to say, that today I will only be in 1+1 dimensions, and I will only talk about zero-form global symmetry. But similar statement can be made in higher dimensions and for higher form global symmetry, but I will not talk about those. And let me start with some discussion about bosonization and fermionization in 1+1D. Of course, this is a very old subject, but I think many of the subtleties in bosonization and fermionization has only been recently clarified and discussed by many people, including people in this room. So Davide, Anton, Laksha, Ryan Thorngren, Karch, David Tong, Carl Turner, and also Theo Johnson-Free, and many other people have various interesting works clarifying various subtleties of bosonization and fermionization. And the discussion here will more or less follow their work. Okay, so when we first took quantum field theory in a classroom, one thing that we learned, or that we were taught, is that in 1+1D, a Majorana fermion, a non-chiral Majorana fermion, so the left and the right central charge are both 1/2. We were taught that the Majorana fermion is the same as the Ising CFT. Here I mean massless Majorana fermion. By Ising CFT, more specifically, I meant the 3,4 minimal model. But this equality, although we heard it many times, cannot possibly be correct at face value. Among other things, the Ising CFT is a bosonic quantum field theory, whereas the Majorana fermion is a fermionic quantum field theory. To define a bosonic quantum field theory on your Riemann surface, you do not need to pick a spin structure, whereas for fermionic quantum field theory, you do need to pick a spin structure. Therefore, it doesn't make any sense to say that the two theories are identical at face value. Of course, the more precise statement is that if you take the Majorana fermion and you bosonize it, you get the Ising model. And by bosonization, the precise meaning is that you sum over the spin structures. To make this point even sharper, let's ask the following question. So, what are the global symmetries of a Majorana fermion and of the Ising CFT? For Majorana fermion, we have both the left moving and the right moving mode. So we can have a chiral fermion parity minus 1 to the f left that flips the sign of only the left moving fermion, but holding the right moving fermion fixed. And vice versa, we can have a right fermion chiral, right chiral fermion parity that leaves the left moving fermion fixed, but the right one flipped by a sign. So the unitary global symmetry of a non-chiral Majorana fermion is just Z2 cross Z2. Okay. On the other hand, what's the global symmetry of an Ising CFT? Well, as far as we can tell, it's only a single Z2. It's the Z2 that flips the spin of your Ising CFT. So it leaves the energy operator invariant and the spin field flipped by a sign. Here, the subscripts denote this left and right conformal dimensions. So even their global symmetries are not the same. So it doesn't make any sense to say that the Majorana fermion is the same as the Ising CFT. And we know precisely what we meant. What we meant is that, as I just said, you should sum over the spin structure. To go from the Majorana fermion to the Ising CFT. But then what happens to the Z2 cross Z2 global symmetries as you sum over the spin structures? As you sum over the spin structures, so you lose the diagonal fermion parity. Because up to some subtlety, you can roughly think about it as gauging the minus 1 to the f. So you definitely lose the diagonal fermion parity. However, you gain a quantum symmetry in the Ising model, because in two dimensions, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, when you gauge a abelian global symmetry, you gain another copy of the global symmetry in the gauged theory. That's the quantum symmetry in the sense of Wafa. So this Z2 is the quantum symmetry emergent from summing over the spin structure. So we lose one, but we gain one. But that doesn't explain what happened to the other Z2 in the Majorana fermion. Why are we only left with a single Z2? So just to write down what I said, start with the Majorana fermion. Consider minus 1 to the f. That's the diagonal of minus 1 to the f left cross minus 1 to the f right. When you gauge, when you sum over the spin structure, there's an emergent Z2 coming from this process. But then you can ask, what happened to the chiral fermion parity, minus 1 to the f left? Well, we can try to track how does this guy act. Minus 1 to the f left is trying to flip the sign of the energy operator. The energy operator, in terms of the Majorana fermion variable, is psi left times psi right, and therefore, minus 1 to the f left is trying to flip the sign of epsilon. However, that cannot possibly be a Z2 global symmetry in the Ising model. Because in the Ising model, we have the OPE that sigma cross sigma is 1 plus epsilon. So flipping the sign of this guy will not respect the OPE. But that actually does not mean minus 1 to the f left is broken under bosonization. What happens is that it becomes a duality defect. In the Ising model, it becomes a topological defect in the Ising model that's not associated with any global symmetry, because we know from the beginning that the Ising model only has a Z2 global symmetry, not anymore. But then there's a missing piece from one of the Z2 in terms of the fermionic description. And that chiral fermion parity actually becomes a non-symmetry defect in the bosonic Ising model. So we are familiar with the phenomenon that if you have two global symmetry groups, G1 and G2, and if they have a mixed anomaly between them. So let's say you have G1 and G2. G2 is free of an anomaly, and there's a mixed anomaly between G1 and G2. Because G2 is free of anomaly, you can gauge G2. But G1 will then get extended because of the mixed anomaly between G1 and G2. Here is a little bit similar to that. There's a mixed anomaly between the chiral fermion parity. And the minus one to the F. And therefore, as you sum over the spin structure, this thing, quote unquote, get extended to something else. Except that in this case, the novelty is that we are not really gauging a symmetry, we are summing over the spin structures. And consequently, this extension is not the usual extension of group, but it becomes an extension of a symmetry to a non-symmetry defect. So we conclude that this non-symmetry defect is actually not something too exotic. It already exists in the bosonic Ising CFT, and its origin is clear. It comes from the chiral fermion parity. And in fact, it's called a duality defect because it implements the Kramers-Wenier duality. One way to see that is that it flips the sign. It flips the sign of the energy operators. So when you turn on the relevant deformation, epsilon, from the Ising CFT point, this duality defect will flip the sign of the relevant deformation. The epsilon deformation is turning on the temperature away from the critical point. And flipping the sign of it is exchanging the low temperature and the high temperature deformation. So this defect is implementing the high temperature, low temperature duality, namely the Kramers-Wenier duality. Okay. So what are the topological defects of the Ising CFT? We have the identity defect I. We have a Z2 defect that will be denoted as eta. And we have a duality defect that will be denoted as n. And their fusion looks like the following. So eta is a Z2 symmetry defect. So by definition, if you have two eta, you should get identity. And if you fuse eta with n, it's the same as n with eta, and the same as n. If you fuse two n together, you get a 1 plus eta. And that's another way to see that this defect n is not a symmetry defect. Because for it to be a symmetry defect, when you multiply two group elements together, you should only get one element on the right-hand side. You should get a group multiplication. But this n is actually not a symmetry defect because when you multiply with itself, you get more than one object on the right-hand side. So it actually forms a ring instead of a group multiplication. And in particular, it means that the duality defect does not have an inverse, in the sense that there's no topological defect such that when you multiply with n, you get just the identity. So the precise mathematical term for such a defect is that it's a non-invertible defect. So this is the full set of topological defects of Ising CFT. And the philosophy throughout the talk is that we should not just focus on the symmetry part that we are familiar with. We should also include the non-symmetry defect. And
so this dual defect, is it the same thing as the taking one Ivy model and another is the Ramaswamy dual description and glue together?
Yeah.
It's that's, the same thing?
Yeah, so
it sounds like if you have two copies of that, you come back to the original thing.
So when you say the Quemier's Wenier duality copy of that, so you are imagining that you put a duality defect here? Right, and on one side you have Ising, and on the other side you perform the Quemier's Wenier duality. So literally at the CFT point, the Ising CFT is self-dual. So what you can do is to start with the Ising CFT under a Z2 orbifold. So at the CFT point, this is a defect in the same CFT. So on the left and on the right, you have the identical Ising CFT. Okay. But then you can choose to turn on the relevant deformation. So we can turn on a plus epsilon on the right-hand side, which corresponds to increase the temperature. And on the left-hand side, because epsilon anti-commutes with the duality defect, it becomes minus epsilon.
Okay.
So it's a defect such that you set it up in a single Ising CFT, and then you turn on relevant deformation. And then on two sides of the duality line, on one side you go to a high temperature phase, on the other side you go to the low.
What yeah. I was asking is then suppose that I have two such parallel.
Oh, right.
Then if you go to epsilon minus epsilon, epsilon, but suppose that you shrink it, that's like a typical.
Right. Right.
Product of
right.
And then if the minus epsilon region shrinks,
right.
It looks like nothing happened. So I agree except that NM is equal to identity. So.
It's not like nothing happens, right? So when you shrink,
something singular happens, and that explains.
No.
When you shrink, you end up with a. So one turn. One turn is the identity, but the other turn is a Z2 defect.
I see. So you're saying that when you shrink it, something non-trivial event. Yeah, I see.
So you have a Z2 defect between the say both the high temperature phase of the Ising when you shrink. All right, so that's just, let's try to orient ourselves here. So in the Ising case, if you just look at the symmetry part, then it's described by the Z2 group. And as typical in any discussion of the global symmetry, we can talk about its Tuhoff anomaly. And Tuhoff anomaly generally, well, in 1 plus 1D bosonic system, is for a finite group, is classified by the group cohomology. And the philosophy of the talk is that whenever you talk about symmetry, you should also make the same statement for the topological defect. For the topological defects, if you fuse two lines, sorry, say again?
Did you already explain the fusion rule?
Oh, did I explain this fusion rule? Oh, so I did not. So maybe let me explain it now. So in any diagonal rational CFT in 1 plus 1D, the fusion rules of the lines will be isomorphic to the fusion rules of the local operators. So there are various ways to see that. You can show it by exploiting the consistency condition of topological defects. But another way to see that is just that for a diagonal rational CFT from the work of Moore and Seiberg, we know that you can break it into the chiral and the anti-chiral half with and extend it to a 2 plus 1D bulk. And a 2 plus 1D bulk is described by the corresponding modular tensor category. And the picture of having a topological defect circling around the local operators becomes the linking between two anions in the 2 plus 1D bulk. And therefore, the topological lines becomes the anions in the modular tensor category. And that's why the topological lines in a diagonal rational CFT obeys the same fusion rules as the associated modular tensor category. In the Ising case, this is the Ising fusion ring. But if you don't like that explanation, there's also a way to do it completely in 1 plus 1D. So for the usual symmetry, if you fuse two defect, you just get a group multiplication law. And there's an anomaly associated with the global symmetry that's formally classified by the group cohomology. For the topological defects, when you fuse two defects, you don't get a group, you actually get a ring. So for example, for this duality defect, when you fuse two of them, you get this kind of result. And there's also an generalization of the anomaly for topological defects. And it's in terms of the crossing behavior of the topological lines, which I will probably not say too much at this talk. And at the end of the day, what classifies the anomaly becomes a solution to certain Pentagon identity. And the appropriate mathematical framework to describe the topological defects in bosonic 1 plus 1D systems is through the tensor category of topological lines. Oh, actually, I can erase this a little bit. So we all love and like anomaly because anomaly has various implications in the low energy. One example is that if you have anomaly, that typically means that in the low energy, your infrared phase cannot be trivially gapped. And this is for the ordinary global symmetry. For topological defects, since topological defects are natural generalization of symmetry and anomaly, you can show that for certain topological defects, it has similar consequences. It forbids the low energy phase to be trivially gapped. And by certain, that would take another talk to explain it. And that's one thing that in the third 2018 paper on the blackboard that we investigated. So in a way that the topological defects are just as good as the global symmetry. And when we use symmetry to constrain the dynamics of quantum field theory, we should also generalize all these methods to topological defects. All right, so that's basically what I want to say about the Ising model. And now I want to switch gear to the main topic for today, the monster CFT. So the previous discussion is just kind of to set up the stage to explain and introduce the topological defects in the simplest possible quantum field theory in 1 plus 1D. Now we want to talk about monster CFT. So let me see, how should I write this? So let me first write Ising here. So Ising CFT is a C left equals to C right equals to 1/2 CFT. As we just discussed, its symmetry is Z2. But symmetry should be thought of as a subset of topological defects. And in this case, the full set of topological defects is listed there. And I'll call this set of topological defects as the Ising category. And now let's talk about monster CFT. So monster CFT is a holomorphic CFT with central charge 24, with the left moving central charge 24 and vanishing right central charge. And it's interesting for various reasons. And I'm not going to list all of them. First, its very existence give a physical explanation. For the monstrous moonshine. So in the simplest incarnation of the monstrous moonshine phenomenon, it's saying that suppose you consider the torus partition function of the monster CFT. It's the Klein's J function minus a constant. And it has the expansion 1 over Q plus 196884. And this large number can be written as 1 plus 196883. And this turns out to be the ERAP of the smallest, turns out to be the dimensions of the smallest ERAP of the monster group. This is the simplest incarnation of the monstrous moonshine, which relates the subject of modular form with finite group. And the very existence of the monster CFT, which is a 1 plus 1D conformal field theory with monster group symmetry, gives a nice physical explanation for this mathematical connection. And another significance about the monster CFT is that it was proposed as a candidate dual for pure gravity in 83 by Witten in 2007. Okay. So let me say a little bit more about the statement of monster moonshine. So for physicists, usually we use the term moonshine for the phenomenon that we have some quantities and we expand it out, and we notice that the coefficients are related to the irreducible representations of finite group. But of course, that's not a very precise notion for mathematicians, because you can always say certain large number is the sum of a lot of ones, and one is always a representation of finite group. So for mathematicians, they have a more precise way to talk about it. For mathematicians, the phenomenon of monster moonshine is a statement that you take any group element of the monster group. So the monster CFT has the symmetry group, the monster group, which I'll denote by this curly weird font M. So the statement for mathematician is that you take any group element of the monster group, then you can try to twist the partition function, the torus partition function, by a symmetry line. So this means that now you are taking the trace over the original Hilbert space, but with this group element G inserted in your trace. And this is what they call the Mackay-Thompson series. For the group element G. And the mathematical statement for the monstrous moonshine is that this series G, TG, has certain nice modular property, which let me, for the time being, just say it has the genus zero property. I'll elaborate more on what that means more precisely later. But now, following the same philosophy that we set up in the first half of the talk, whenever we have a statement associated with global symmetry, we should try our best to generalize to topological defects. So the statement of the monstrous moonshine is associated with every group element of the monster group symmetry. if there are other topological defects that are not associated to global symmetry in the monster CFT, you can similarly twist the partition function and obtain a Q series. And you can ask if there are similar mathematical property for such partition function. And that's going to be the main subject of the talk. Namely, we know the monster CFT has the monster group as its global symmetry. But what is the full set of topological defects in the monster CFT? So in the talk today, so the monster group will be some subcategory of this bigger category of topological lines. And the point of the talk today is that we're going to show that the Ising category enjoyed by the Ising CFT is actually a subcategory of the topological lines of the monster CFT. In other words, we can say that the monster CFT has a Kramer's Wernier duality, just like the Ising CFT. So how do we identify this non-symmetry topological lines in the monster CFT? So we're going to identify it and later on compute the generalized Mackay-Thompson series following this spirit. The main point of the talk today is that the monster CFT has the Ising category. And we will define the torus partition function. Twist it by the non-symmetry defect. Which will be called a defect Mackay-Thompson series. And we are going to show that it has certain genus zero property. But not quite the same as the ordinary Mackay-Thompson series. And finally, we are going to comment that this series, its coefficients can be naturally decomposed. So this line will be similar to the notion of moonshine for mathematicians. But since I think most of you guys are physicists, I'm just going to also to comment that the series can also be decomposed into the E-reps of representations of certain finite group. So the monster group is the largest sporadic finite group, and the second largest is the baby monster group. And this defect Mackay-Thompson series, its coefficients can be naturally decomposed into irreducible representations of the baby monster. So we're going to play the same trick. We are going to, so recall that in Ising CFT, how do we identify the Kramer's Wernier duality defect? Oh, sorry, is there a question? Yes. Yeah, so that will be the outlook part of the talk. In fact, we found many, many non-invertible topological defects. In fact, In the monster CFT, there are going to be infinitely many non-invertible topological defects coming from the Leech lattice description. But so this Ising category, this duality defect, is just one of the infinitely many non-invertible topological defects. At the end of the talk, I will probably mention some other interesting non-invertible topological defects that we have also identified. Right now, let me just focus on the Ising one.
Why is the infinitely,
should still be finite? Is it rational? So the reason is because if you can realize the monster CFT as a Z2 orbifold of the Leech lattice CFT, the Leech lattice CFT has a lot of U1 global symmetry. If you have a continuous global symmetry, then you have a continuum of topological defects. Right? So you take any group element, that's a topological defect. Of course, when you go from the Leech to the monster, you do a Z2 orbifold to kill the U1 global symmetry. But there are still infinitely many defects surviving through that process. So the short answer is that it roughly comes from the continuous global symmetries of the Leech lattice CFT. But I haven't studied much about those. I don't know if they have nice properties. But let me talk about these ones that are more rational in certain specific sense. Yeah?
So all the non-symmetry defects, do they come from some global symmetry before
orbifolding
something?
Like,
are all examples like that?
Or? To be honest, I don't know. This one does. And Theo is shaking his head, so probably not.
I can get much more exotic, weird, medium-sized topological defects by reaching deep into the Kneser graph and grabbing a symmetry of some kind of lattice far away and moving it through a sequence of dualities to some complicated topological defect on the monster. I mean, those, like the ones I can give you still come from symmetries far away, but I see no reason why there wouldn't be. Like, they're so far away, they don't look like symmetries in any reasonable description of the theory.
Yeah. But for the Ising category, then yes, you can realize that through summing over the structures, the spin structures. And that's going to be our strategy. So recall that in the Ising CFT, how do we identify the duality defect? We identify it from the chiral fermion parity in the Majorana fermion system. So now let's try to play the same game. But for that, we need a little bit machinery of going in the opposite direction. Because here we start from the fermion and land on the boson. But now we know the boson theory. For the current case, it's the monster CFT. So we want to go backwards. We want to fermionize the monster CFT. So we start with the monster CFT in the middle, which is a bosonic CFT. And we want to fermionize it. When you bosonize, you sum over the spin structure. When you fermionize, you actually pick a non-anomalous Z2 global symmetry and couple it to an invertible spin TQFT, and then you gauge that Z2. So we need to make a choice of the Z2. In monster CFT, there are two Z2s up to conjugation. We have a Z2A and a Z2B. They're both non-anomalous. And it is well known that if you gauge Z2B, you get another bosonic CFT, which is the Leech lattice CFT. So this is the free boson CFT with target space being the 24-dimensional Leech lattice, still holomorphic. And if you do the Z2A orbifold, you go back to the monster. And that's the simplest incarnation that
there has to be a duality defect. In the Ising case, we know Ising is self-dual under gauging the Z2 because there's only one C equals to 1/2 unitary minimal model. And that self-duality under the Z2 orbifold actually implies there's a duality non-symmetry defect. But that's not a totally obvious fact, and I probably won't explain why. And similarly here, the monster is self-dual under Z2A, so that's already a hint that there has to be a duality defect. But more explicitly, you can try to fermionize the both of the Z2. So let's maybe first do the Z2B, although that's not going to be the main focus of the talk. So you can fermionize 2B, and you get a fermionic CFD. This fermionic CFD has been studied in the 80s by Dixon, Ginsberg, and Harvey. And this is called the Beauty and the Beast. Super conformal field theory. So this is a C left equals to 24, C right equals to 0, N equals to 1, super conformal field theory. Super conformal, so of course it's fermionic. For any fermionic CFD, you can always multiply it by an R invariant. Not going to say too much about it, and what it does is just relabeling what do you mean by the fermion and what do you mean by the boson in the Ramon sector. So you basically get the same CFD, but differ by this 1 plus 1D counter term. And this actually also can be reached by fermionize the dual symmetry of the Z2B here. And of course, the arrow goes the other way if you sum over the spin structure. So with respect to this non-anomalous Z2B, there are two bosonic theories and one fermionic theory. You can think about this too as a single fermionic theory because their difference is just an R invariant, which can be thought of as a 1 plus 1D counter term. But this is not the main focus. This was known in the 80s. The main focus today is that we're going to fermionize the other Z2, the Z2A. And if you follow this procedure, what you'll find is that the theory on the left is a free fermion times a fermionic CFD that's called a baby monster CFD. So a free fermion has C left equals to 1/2, and baby monster CFD has C left equals to 47 over 2, so that they add up to 24. So this completes the diagram for the Z2 fermion for the fermionization of the monster CFD. And this is the part that we are going to focus on. This part is also known in certain incarnation for the VOA mathematicians. This is actually the way they constructed the baby monster vertex operator algebra. But now stated in the physics term, it means that the fermion times the baby monster CFD is the fermionization of the monster CFD. And at this point, you can probably already guess the answer, where the duality defect comes from. The fact that there's a free fermion here means that there's a chiral fermion parity. And that, when you bosonize back, give you the Kremers-Wenner duality defect of the monster CFD. So through this diagram, we have already shown that there has to be an Ising category. Well, there has to be a duality defect for the monster CFD. Now, we have this duality defect. We would like to ask, how does it act on the operators in the monster CFD? But then you can also figure it out without trouble, because you know that in the fermionic description, the duality defect is the chiral fermion parity. So it only acts on this sector without touching the other. So more explicitly, let's write down some partition functions. So the monster CFT partition function is just a J function. Monster CFT can be realized as the GSO projection of the free fermion and the baby monster CFT. So that means we can write this partition function as a sum over in this form. Where the baby monster BOA has three representations, h equals to 0, 3 half, and h equals to 31 over 16. And you should think about these operators in the Unger sector and this one in the Ramon sector. And this expression is basically the GSO projection in going from here to here. From this description, it's now obvious how the duality defect should act. The duality defect, putting an N line here, let me try to say it better. So this is like the vacuum piece. So naively, you would think the vacuum piece should just come with eigenvalue 1. But that's actually not quite true. The eigenvalue of the vacuum piece is square root 2. There are various ways to understand the square root 2. So this duality defect comes from the chiral fermion parity in the fermionic theory. So that means on the defect in the low energy, there's going to be a 0 plus 1d Majorana 0 most, the Kitaev's chain, living on the defect. And the NS sector partition function of a 0 plus 1d Majorana fermion is square root 2. So this square root 2 comes from that. Another way to understand it is that it's the quantum dimension of the non-invertible line in the Ising category. So this is like a vacuum expectation value for the line. And as we said, the duality line was a chiral fermion parity. So you should flip the sign of the second term. And what I did not explain is that the duality defect will annihilate the spin field in the Ising case. So that's the full answer. So in this way, we obtain the action of the duality defect on the monster CFT operators. Let's comment more explicitly how it works. So with respect to the duality defect, from the fusion, it has three possible eigenvalues. Eigenvalues can be plus square root 2, minus square root 2, or 0. In the Ising case, this is the identity operator, this is the energy operator, and this is the spin field. In the monster case, let's look at the operators at h equals to 2. The scaling dimension equals to 2 operators. So what are those operators? So there are 1, 9, 6, 8, 8, 4 of them. So and that's 1 plus the smallest e rep, of the monster finite group. How do they decompose into different eigenvalue sector under the duality defect? So there's a stress energy tensor descendant that's obviously have plus root 2 eigenvalue. Other than that, it decomposes into 1 plus 9, 6, 2, 5, 5. And this is the smallest ERAP of the baby monster group. And then there are 4, 3, 7, sorry, this is not the smallest one. I think this is the second smallest one. And this is the smallest one. And then for the 0, 1, for the eigenvalue 0 sector, there are 9, 6, 2, 5, 6. And you can do a simple exercise. If you add 1 plus 1, add this, that gives you the 196AA4. So that's how the 196AA4 decomposes into different eigenvalue sectors of the duality defect. So the duality defect does not commute with the monster group. So the duality defect is not just some stupid tensor product with the monster group. The irreducible representation of the monster group splits into different eigenvalue sector of the duality defect. But the duality defect does commute with the baby monster group, which is a subgroup of monster. That sentence is not completely precise, but I'll leave it like that. Yeah.
Is there a sort of physical justification for why 96,256 is one more than 96,256?
I don't know. Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, you are asking why the smallest projective representation of baby monster is one higher than the second smallest faithful linear representation. I don't know. Yeah. I was hoping that you have a better mathematical interpretation for that.
I was hoping, sure, but they don't. It would be great if you could tell us some story that said, well, actually, there's some, I don't know, superconformal structure or something that was moving, that was mirroring these.
That would be nice, yeah. But as you know, as we discussed, I don't know if there's a supersymmetry. Maybe there is.
I don't know if superconformal structure is the right thing. I just mean,
right. Yeah. All right, so I have a few minutes left. Let me see, what do I want to talk about? So we have identified a duality defect in the monster CFT, and we figure out how it acts on all the local operators through the fermionic description. And in the last minute or two, I just want to comment on some mathematical aspect. So coming back to the mathematical statement of the monstrous moonshine, it's that you pick any group element of the monster group, twist the partition function, you get a series, and then you should try to figure out the invariance group of this series, this invariance group in PSL2R, of the series. And the genus zero property, roughly speaking, is that if you take the upper half plane and you quotient by this invariance group, you should get a genus zero curve after some compactification. That's the essence of the monstrous moonshine for the ordinary monster group. Since duality defects is a natural generalization of the monster group symmetry, you can ask whether the defect Mackay-Thompson series has the similar genus zero property. And the answer is not conclusive, and let me tell you why. So here it's actually important that we are talking about the invariance group inside SL2R, not SL2Z. And generally, I don't really know a strategy to determine. If you hand me a Q series, I don't know the strategy to figure out its invariance group inside SL2R. But I do know how to figure out the invariance group inside SL2Z. This is because the defect Mackay-Thompson series is built out of the characters of the Ising CFT in the baby monster vertex operator algebra. And we know they're modular S and T matrices. So from that, we can figure out the SL2Z invariance group. So the defect, a Kai-Thompson series, is invariance group is it doesn't really have a nice name, and I actually did a lot of Google to find a website classifying all the genus zero congruent subgroup inside SL2Z. And on that website, and there's an associated published paper, they have a name for this group. It's called 16D0. I'll give a definition for this group. So this is a congruent subgroup of PSL2Z. And its definition is, are all the group elements inside PSL2Z that satisfy the union of these two relations. Okay? And we know everything about this group. It's index 24. It's a congruent subgroup at level 16. That's what the 16 is for. Now, an encouraging fact is that it's the superscript 0. The superscript 0 means that it's a genus 0 group. So we don't know the invariance group of the defect Mackay-Thompson series in SL2R, but we did find the invariance group inside SL2Z, and it is a genus zero group. So maybe the more general defect Mackay-Thompson series will also have similar genus zero property. That remains to be explored. So lastly, let me just comment on one of the questions that was asked earlier. What are the other non-invertible topological defects in the monster CFD? So the following comment was pointed out by Theo to me. So in monster CFT, if you take any prime number that divides the order of the monster group, let's say P, then there's a ZP orbital of the monster CFT such that it's self-dual. For example, when P is 2, that's the Z2A orbital that we've been talking about. And this generalizes to all the prime number that divides the monster group order. So for every such prime number, there should be a duality defect associated with it. And it would be interesting to figure out its action on the monster CFT. And so far, we have only worked out the Z2 case and the Z3 case. And another way to proceed is that you see that this duality defect is naturally associated with this decomposition of the monster CFT into the baby monster module and the Ising module. So for every such decomposition, there will be some natural topological defects associated with it. And from that point of view, we have also identified a Fibonacci non-invertible line. It's a line that satisfies the fusion algebra of W squared is 1 plus W. It's perhaps one of the simplest fusion category of topological defects. So there seems to be many, many topological lines, and it will be interesting to furnish the usual moonshine phenomena through this physics point of view. All right, I'll stop it here.
Thank you for a nice talk. So now we have time for questions and comments.
Yeah.
So you take other duality, for example, let's take SDRT for the N equal 4, for example.
Yeah.
In your language, do you still say that there is a non-symmetry defect associated with the SDRT?
Is that necessarily a non-symmetry defect? That could be just, so if you take 4D n equals to 4, goes to tau equals to I, then there's a Z2 symmetry,
yeah.
Right? So I think in that case, the duality defect is a symmetry defect. I think it just becomes a Z2 global symmetry defect. Here's the duality is about self-duality under the orbital. Another example is considered T-duality. Yes. The T-duality of the C equals to one self-dual boson. Their T-duality at that point is also a symmetry defect, but it's not Z2, it's Z4. It's an order for anomalous symmetry.
Thanks.